are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. After racking up more primary wins this week, former Vice President Joe Biden has nearly secured the Democratic nomination for president. Coming up, we'll look at potential running mates for Biden, including the impact of nationwide protests on his decision. Now, the American economy depends a lot on consumer spending. And while the economy was riding high by many measures just a few months ago, the novel coronavirus outbreak caused the system to sputter. Many people here in Wisconsin and around the country lost their jobs or had their hours cut back. And even for people who didn't lose their incomes, fears of a recession drove many to cut back on non-essential spending. Our next guest joins us to talk about why consumer spending is down and why the COVID-19 pandemic could alter how Americans spend their money in the long run. Ann Helen Peterson is a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She recently wrote the piece, "I Don't Feel Like Buying Stuff Anymore." Ann, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Ann, you dig into the big picture, past, present, and future of shopping, but you start with your own story. What have you been experiencing as you think about buying stuff since the pandemic started?
Yeah, and I wonder if other people have experienced this as well. But as I was looking through all of the emails that I get, you know, from every place that I've ever bought something from, I get, you know, sale reminders, all sorts of stuff just cluttering up my inbox. And I would look at them and I'd be like, why would I want to click on that? You know, why do I need a new pair of jeans? Even if it's on super sale, who do I need new jeans for? And so I started thinking about just the general disinclination to buy any new things and what was going on there.
And clearly, in one way or another, it's not just you. We've seen retail sales go down a lot, partly, of course, because stores are closed. But as you look around, what kind of signs do you see out there that American consumers are rethinking consuming, at least for now?
Well, I think part of it is anecdotal, of course, just people saying, like, you know, why would I need to buy more things? I talked to hundreds of people through a survey to get their perspective on what they were and were not buying. But then also, as you pointed out, just the actual numbers are way down in terms of consumer spending that people track just in terms of credit card spending and that sort of thing. And obviously, people are, you know, not spending because they're scared that they're not going to have future paychecks or just trying to be more frugal in general. But I think a lot of the things that we usually spend money on, it's not just that we can't go out, right? It's not just that we can't go to the movies or go have dinner out. It's more, you know, if I can't, you know, see other people, if I'm not going into work every day, why would I need a new outfit? Why do I need new makeup? All of those sorts of things.
We heard from Andy on the Ideas Network Facebook page who writes, "I buy a lot less because being at home has brought into focus how much less I need to survive and be happy. Plus," Andy writes, "it's allowed me to reconnect with my passion for cooking, which means we aren't spending as much eating out." But that mindset change is something you're wondering about in your piece, the idea that, as Andy said, maybe I don't need the stuff that I thought I did to be happy. Could you talk about that, Ann?
Yeah, yeah. I think it can sound kind of cheesy because it's a little bit like, you know, I just like appreciate the world that I have. I appreciate the small things in my home, the small comforts that I have accumulated around myself. But I too have like returned to cooking in a way that I haven't in a long time. And I think part of that is just I'm not traveling at all, right? I am not frantic in terms of like trying to slam a lot of things into my schedule. I am stressed out for other reasons, but it's not from doing a lot of stuff. And so there is a little bit more space to explore the things that you already have. And I think like cooking, as this person noted, is one of them. I'm gardening. I know people who've told me they've gotten like really into sewing. And this is part of the reason too, that I think if you go to Home Depot or a hardware store, you will see a lot of people there buying things. But a lot of that is directed towards making things, right? Which feels very different than just accumulating things.
We're talking to Ann Helen Peterson, senior culture writer for BuzzFeed News, looking at how shopping has changed in the short run during and after the coronavirus pandemic and what it might change in the future. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. How has shopping and the concept of shopping changed for you during all of this? And is have you made changes that you think are going to stick down the road? 800-642-1234. And in your piece, you also look at the past of shopping and the way that, you know, being a consumer has been part of American identity and so crucial to the American economy. And you point toward a key moment at the end of World War II when Americans had been rationing for so long. And all of a sudden, there's this economic boom and our shopping is a big driver of it. Can you talk about that turning point?
Yeah, you know, during World War II, there was this idea that to be patriotic, you wouldn't consume. Right? You'd participate in rationing and just generally, you know, preserving whatever things that were available for the troops and towards the war effort. And then after World War II, the idea became the way to make America robust, right? The way to come roaring back again after this war is to consume, in part because by buying something like a washing machine, you are putting people who work in that factory to work, right? And at that time, they were being paid wages that would then allow them to go out and buy their own washing machine. So it was an idea of kind of, you know, producing a sort of equality by consuming. And I think some of that still sticks around, like, you know, consume to keep America strong. Like that is still an idea that is very prevalent, and that was prevalent after 9/11 and even during the Great Recession. But I think people are really realizing that, like, oh, now when I buy something, the only person who really benefits from it are the people who maybe own these companies.
And I've had a version of that, you know, for smaller businesses and smaller restaurants. I try to buy stuff from them in general, and I feel like a sense of a duty in this time, since I know they're hurting, to go out and buy things from them. Do you feel, and have you seen other people feeling that kind of motivation to at least buy something to help those little guys stay around?
Yeah. I think people who are employed or still have money right now do feel a duty to support local businesses because they feel like part of the thing that makes their community what it is are these local businesses, right? And they want them to stick around. I do think, though, by putting all of the burden on the individual, especially the individual who is already maybe, you know, trying to save or being taxed doesn't have a lot of expendable income, that there needs to be other forces that are helping these businesses as well. Like the responsibility for keeping these businesses afloat can't entirely fall on the individual.
Well, it seems like there's just two values in contradiction here. Like, you know, frugality, I think in the United States, we think of that as a virtue in some ways, and saving money, that's a great idea. But if everybody's doing that, it really throws a wrench into the way our economy works.
See, I think that we only idealistically think of frugality as an American value. Everything in our lives tells us to spend and to spend beyond our means. So the incredible availability of credit speaks to that. This idea that, like, I mean, when we say, can you afford something? What does that even mean anymore? We borrow against, you know, our paycheck all the time, or like just to even go to school. What does it mean to actually afford something? We don't buy something because we can afford it. We buy it because we want it. And so I think that what we're really seeing is a reexamination of that drive to consume beyond our means.
Is that something you saw starting already after the Great Recession? What's that been, a decade plus ago? Were people already, do you think, starting to reevaluate in that direction?
Well, I think people were very aware of how difficult it has become to keep the idea of being middle class, right? To the outward experience of being middle class, just in terms of like stability and having a home or having two cars, all of those sorts of things, you have to borrow a lot in order to make that happen. And so increasingly people were like, this isn't working. I am not middle class. Like, I'm not keeping it together. And I think that reality, especially for millennials, many of whom have incredible amounts of student debt and for whom homeownership is just not available to them, they have said, like, this isn't working. I'm drowning. Like, I'm not keeping above water.
We're talking to Anne Helen Peterson right now. She's a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She recently wrote the piece we're talking about titled, I Don't Feel Like Buying Stuff Anymore. It looks at how American consumer spending has changed dramatically since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic and whether that change, at least in some ways, is going to be here to stay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about shopping right now? Did you cut back during the safer at home times? Have you gone back to what you consider your normal shopping habits, or have you reevaluated what you need and what you want to buy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about a drop in consumer spending amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Anne Helen Peterson is with us, senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She recently wrote a piece titled, I Don't Feel Like Buying Stuff Anymore, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have your shopping habits changed over the last couple months, and do you want to keep some of those changes down the road, or are you nervous about going out and spending money, want to save what you have for now amidst the uncertainty? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Dawn is with us in Thiensville. Dawn, hi.
Hello. I just feel like since I was probably 18 years old, I was against the realm of everybody else and buying to the point I kept saying you should have everything that you ever needed at age 30, and at 50 you should have everything you ever needed and never have to buy another thing again. And my kids laugh at me because I ended up being a divorced mom, and it took me until this year at age 50 where I finally had my first real bed, because during the divorce I didn't end up with it, but I had four mattresses stacked on each other. I just saved and saved and saved, and I'm at the point where I own two houses now and didn't have to worry about a thing through the pandemic. But I'll tell you, I was living off of an income of $10,000 6 years ago when I lost my job and ended up with cancer and raising four children. I guess I don't understand these people who just feel they need to buy to satisfy and follow along with everybody else. I was laughed at work because they all bought meals every single day out. They had them delivered to work, and I would bring meals in. I wouldn't even eat in the cafeteria at work. And I guess I'm on the other side, Dawn, of that, where frugality was my term.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Wow. Okay. Virtue out of necessity there, I guess, Anne. But Dawn's not alone in feeling like people buy more than they need.
Yeah. And I think that that idea of frugality is really, I don't know how to put this in a way that isn't weird, but I think that it's becoming fashionable again. You know, during the pandemic, people were really trying to limit and continue to try to limit their grocery store trips. And so one thing that I saw like all over Facebook and Instagram was regrowing your green onions from like the bottoms. Like, you're basically regrowing vegetables and other things, like, oh, washing tinfoil or a plastic bag. And these are things that my grandparents used to do, who, you know, lived through the Depression. Like, these are practices that were put in place in times of great deprivation that, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. They're actually really great. They're great for the environment. They're great in so many different ways. And I think that they've become something that, you know, as the caller said, we make fun of people about. But at the same time, like, there's so much spending that is completely unnecessary, and that we either just don't think about, or we kind of go along with as compulsory, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. At 800-642-1234. We'll go to Sarah now in Oconto Falls. Sarah, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about, Sarah?
Yeah, I just, I can definitely relate to what the conversation is right now. I felt during the pandemic, we were buying more than we had previous. You know, every time we would go to the grocery shop, it was almost like this feeling like you didn't know if you were going to have enough. You know, the next time you went in, you didn't know if what you wanted was going to be there. So instead of the one box, you buy three or four. And I mean, that's completely against, you know, what they said you should have done. And, you know, and then looking back, we also were buying a lot more, like, just random things online, like different things for the kids to do or for the kids to have, you know, and even for ourselves, things that we probably would never have purchased if it hadn't been for the pandemic. And looking back, you know, thinking we were probably trying to fill a void, you know, in lieu of going places and having experiences and seeing the people that we love, you know, I felt like I was probably trying to fill that void for myself and for my kids by purchasing things, you know, and looking back, that probably wasn't the best thing, but it's definitely something to learn from.
Sarah, interesting. Thank you so much for sharing your story and your analysis now looking back. What do you think, Anne?
Yeah, a lot of parents told me that they were buying things kind of out of desperation to keep their kids occupied in some capacity. So like mini trampolines, there have been tons of parents who have bought mini trampolines. And I think that one thing that I heard from people as they reflected on their purchases is that they were trying to fill a void, and that even understanding that before the pandemic, their purchases were trying to fill a void. I know that when I felt really stressed, like when I was on the road for work and just like felt like so many things were happening, if I could just buy something that would fix it, right? Even if that was like a kitchen tool or a new piece of clothing or a face serum, something like that, like somehow purchasing made you feel like you had some control over the situation. And that's all an illusion, right? But it is one of the ways that we're taught in this country to try to like keep things under control. And so one thing that the pandemic just has brought generally for a lot of people, not all, is some space for contemplation and to kind of step back and think about not only why am I buying something, but also, you know, how many people will have to touch this thing in order for it to get to me? Like how many essential workers are necessary in order for me to have this quick fix? And I think that's really good.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sarah, at 800-642-1234. Anne Helen Peterson is with us from BuzzFeed News, talking about a piece she wrote on shopping and how the pandemic may have changed our attitudes in the short run, maybe the long run, toward the stuff we buy. Back to your calls now. Kathy is with us in Milwaukee. Kathy, hello.
Hello. I found that I'm saving a lot of money since I saved several thousand dollars since this pandemic has happened. I don't feel like spending. I'm not going out to eat, and I kind of like it. I think I'll keep doing that.
Kathy, thanks so much for sharing that story. So yeah, Kathy may not be alone, and we've seen, I think, in some numbers I've looked at, Anne, even as stores reopen, there are people like Kathy out there that sales aren't necessarily snapping back to where they were before the pandemic. So Kathy's not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it is I think that a lot of people don't feel safe, even if places are opening. That doesn't mean that consumers feel like they want to be in those places yet. But the other thing, too, is I think that, you know, habits, things become habits after, you know, a couple of weeks, couple of months, like we're in month three, right? And if you're like this caller who has realized, oh, I've saved this money. And also this is my third month and I, you know, do I miss that? I don't think I really do. That's actually a shift in behavior, right? And that could be something that is more longstanding than just kind of like a blip on the radar.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. Back to your calls now. Tina is with us in Madison. Tina, hello.
Hi. I agree with a lot of what other callers have said, and what I think with the pandemic, I realized I had to be maybe just more mindful or intentional about where I spend my money. So I try to spend money up to my donation to, you know, WPR and to other community media. And then also I have really tried to buy local. I think that, you know, somebody had said earlier, just seeing Amazon and other big places gobble up all this money. And so really trying to buy more local things. And now with what's happening in the last week or so, really looking to help small businesses that are owned by people of color. So I will hang up and listen to the comments online. Thanks.
Tina, thanks a lot for the call. Two words there stood out to me, and mindful and intentional when it came to her shopping.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I love that she connected it too to the protests against police brutality that are happening right now. You know, I think we live in a capitalist society. The way that we show what is valuable to us in a lot of ways is by purchasing or not purchasing, you know, directing our money. You can speak with your money. And so people right now are, I think, taking that excess money or just the money that they have that they would usually be spending on other things, and they're directing it to causes and to people that they think deserve it.
Thanks a lot for the call. Time, I think, for one more caller. Joe is on the line in Stevens Point. Joe, hello.
Hey. I've been frugal, or some would call it cheap, all my life. And this is, this thing's have not changed too much for me, and I feel like everybody else now is in my boat.
Joe, thanks a lot for calling in. Yeah, as you were saying, frugality is in, and Joe may have felt like he was out when people called him cheap in the past, but people are hopping into that boat now.
Yeah, I love how this has just turned into a celebration of people who are cheap, right? Well, and even that word, it has a negative connotation, right? Cheap. But frugal is really a way to praise someone, because when you have more money, like, you can do things with it intentionally instead of trying to struggle to make ends meet all the time. But I think, you know, for a lot of people, it's not even just that they are like buying random things on Amazon all the time, right? A lot of people right now in America are struggling to make ends meet because the rent is really high, the pay is really low, and there's not a lot of economic safety net. And so I think that what people are saying is like, I don't want things to be the way that they were before. How can we as society change?
Well, thanks to all our callers. And Anne, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you. This is great.
Anne Helen Peterson is a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She joined us to talk about her recent piece, I Don't Feel Like Buying Stuff Anymore. It looks at the drop in consumer spending because of the COVID-19 pandemic and its economic fallout. By the way, next Tuesday, we'll stick with a related topic and look at how millennials have had the worst economic prospects of any generational group in American history. That conversation's coming up on Tuesday. Coming up today, now that Joe Biden has the Democratic nomination for president essentially wrapped up, we'll look at the field of potential running mates. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with a look at opportunities for paddling, camping, hiking, and biking around the state. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to the Associated Press, former Vice President Joe Biden is 25 delegates away from securing the Democratic nomination for president. In Tuesday's primaries, Biden won 7 states and the District of Columbia, putting him at 1,966 delegates. You need 1,991. He'll likely get there next week when Georgia and West Virginia hold their contests. Many people now are wondering who his running mate will be. He gave us a clue during his debate with Senator Bernie Sanders back in March.
If I'm elected president, my cabinet, my administration will look like the country. And I commit that I will, in fact, pick a woman to be vice president. There are a number of women who are qualified to be president tomorrow. I would pick a woman to be my vice president.
Since last week's death of George Floyd and the protests that followed, calls have been increasing for Biden to choose a black woman. At a campaign event in Delaware on Monday, Biden said he's considering multiple African-American women, along with Latinas and Caucasians. David Schultz is a professor of political science at law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, good to have you back on the show.
It's my pleasure to be on the show again.
Well, before we dig into what the criteria are for a vice presidential selection, do you have thoughts on who a front runner or two might be right about now?
Yeah, right now I would pick two people in terms of the likely front runners. One is Kamala Harris, who's the senator from California. And then the second choice, I think, might be Val Demings, who's a representative from Florida. And for people who might sort of recognize her name, she was also one of the managers who prosecuted the impeachment charges against Donald Trump in the U.S. Senate earlier this year. It almost seems like an eternity ago to be talking about the impeachment.
Now, how much, first of all, in terms of an election outcome, how much does a choice of a running mate matter historically?
Historically, this is sort of one of the great myths, I think, of presidential politics, that there's been several of us, including me, who've done a lot of sort of research into this, some statistical quantitative analysis. And for the most part, vice presidents really don't matter that much. There's very little evidence that vice presidents sway maybe more than maybe a couple percent of the popular vote. There's very little evidence that vice presidents help in terms of, let us say, helping you pick up their home state. So the impact is small. The one vice presidential candidate in recent history that mattered the most was Sarah Palin. And she probably hurt John McCain a little bit in the general election, although she probably helped him with the conservative base within his party. So we have to start by saying that at a time when in the United States where barely half the American public knows the name of the vice president of the United States, thinking that the public is highly motivated by a vice presidential choice is a slightly overblown claim to make.
How about this as a strategy or a way of thinking? I'm a presidential candidate and there's a section of my party that has doubts about me, and I want to assuage those doubts with my choice so they're going to be enthusiastically behind me. So if I'm a Donald Trump and I'm not sure that, you know, evangelicals certainly don't see me as one of their own coming into the presidential election, I pick Mike Pence, who they see as one of their own, and maybe Joe Biden has a similar scenario now.
Yes, I think so. And I think you make a very good point here, is that Mike Pence helped Donald Trump cement the evangelical vote in the same way that John McCain was very effective when he picked Sarah Palin to get the more conservative aspect of his party. So now we have to think in terms of Joe Biden, who has the reputation, maybe deserved, maybe undeserved, within the Democratic Party as being somewhat more of a centrist, more of a moderate, and therefore to win over perhaps the more liberal, let's say the Bernie Sanders supporters, the Elizabeth Warren supporters. He needs to pick somebody that will be more liberal. And at the same time, we know that women, especially suburban women, are a critical constituency within the Democratic Party. In 2016, suburban women stayed home. Donald Trump won. In 2018, in the midterm election, suburban women showed up to vote. Democrats did well. So I think Biden was looking at saying, okay, I need to put a woman on the ticket that helps me with a female vote. Now he's probably looking at saying, I need to maybe get somebody who is, say, more liberal or has a reputation of being more liberal. And perhaps, and you opened up by this, especially given the events in the last week with Mr. Floyd's killing or murder and the protests, maybe he needs to be selecting a woman of color at this point also.
David Schultz is with us, political scientist and law professor at Hamline University, also professor of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at possible running mate selections for Joe Biden. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. If you want to make a case for a particular running mate or against one for that matter, what are you looking for? Wherever you are on the political spectrum, does it matter to you who is the vice presidential candidate for either party, any party? 800-642-1234 is the number. David, let's follow up on that last point. This week of protests after the death of George Floyd, talk about how that might affect, if at all, Joe Biden and who he's looking for here.
Well, I think it affects it in a couple of ways, and especially it affects individuals in a couple of ways also. And by that, I think given the fact that besides women, people of color, especially African Americans, are a very core constituency to the Democratic Party. We know that Joe Biden has generally received strong support from African Americans, but he needs them to turn out in very strong numbers. So it is possible, given what's happened in the last week, that the pressure shifts toward saying that he has to consider not just a female who he's already committed to, but saying a woman of color, more perhaps even more likely African American. Now, this also bodes against somebody. Now, one of my two senators, I'm in Minnesota, is Amy Klobuchar. Amy Klobuchar is on the fairly short list for most people in terms of their estimation as a vice presidential candidate for Joe Biden. I think her candidacy for the vice presidency took a major blow in the last week. And I say that because the officer who is charged with second-degree murder allegedly for killing Mr. Floyd was an individual who had also killed another civilian back in early, well, 2006, I think it was, 2004, when Amy Klobuchar was the county attorney or county prosecutor. And one of the issues that's dogged Amy Klobuchar during this campaign is her prosecutorial record and allegations that she was insensitive to issues of people of color. Now bring this up to the fact that this officer had killed somebody else back then. She declined to prosecute. And now the issue of race policing is in the news. I think Amy Klobuchar took a major hit. I could also say that, you know, I'm in St. Paul, and what happened today was that George Floyd's memorial and funeral was today, and Amy Klobuchar showed up at the funeral, and that the communities of color, the people of color in Minnesota were quite angry about her showing up. Now, I think they would have been angry, and people would have been angry if she didn't show up. And I mention this because I think she's in a precarious situation. Should she have gone? Should she not have gone? But that controversy, I think, hurts her as Joe Biden is and his staff is vetting her and other candidates for vice president.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Rich with us in Door County. Rich, hello.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Rich?
Well, I've analyzed this a bit as well, and I think the 2% swing that your guest talks about is probably correct. However, I think we're in a different position this year, and I'm of the opinion that Mr. Biden could run his pet rock as a vice presidential candidate, and he's safe in the pursuit of the presidency in this year.
Rich, thanks for the call. I'd have to double-check the Constitution on the rock for vice president. Sorry, pet rock, not the rock. But Rich feels confident that Biden would win no matter who. Is it that cut and dried, the outcome in November?
No, it's not. No. Yeah, no, it's not that cut and dry. As I analyze it at this point, now remember, it's not the popular vote that elects the presidency. It's the race to get to 270 electoral votes. As I see it right now, there's about 43 states that are pretty locked in at this point in terms of where we know where they're going to go. I have a guess that somewhere around 211 electoral votes are locked in for Biden. Around 206, 207 approximately are locked in for Trump. There's about 111 electoral votes in play, including Wisconsin. And if you look at those seven swing states, the polls are pretty close at this point. We've got states like what? Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, Arizona. Right now, it's so volatile that I wouldn't say it's a lock in the Electoral College. I would go as far as saying that I think Biden probably wins the popular vote, probably wins it by as great a number, if not greater number or percentage than Hillary Clinton won back 4 years ago. But it's not the popular vote. It's the Electoral College. And right now in those swing states, it's just too close to call.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking about potential running mates for Joe Biden. David Schultz is with us, professor of political science at law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have someone you want to see running at Joe Biden's side? How important is the pick to you in general? Does it matter to you who a running mate is in a presidential race for either party? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about potential running mates for Joe Biden. He won 8 more Democratic primaries this week as he inches closer to locking up the nomination for president. David Schultz is with us, professor of political science and law at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who do you want to see as a running mate for the Democrats? Who don't you want to see? You can name names or characteristics or whatever. 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls now. Steve is with us in Whitewater. Steve, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Steve?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the point that I think whoever that we as Americans are nominating for representing us, that we should look at what their ideas are and elect them or choose them based on that rather than, external features or characteristics, whether it be skin color, whether it be, well, they're a woman or their sexuality. I think that what their ideas are and what the content of their character is far more important than any of those external characteristics of them. And I would encourage all of my fellow Americans to vote based on the content and the ideas.
Steve. Thanks a lot for the call, Steve, saying, hey, let's not tick off demographic boxes here. David, what do you think?
Well, I think that's admirable, and I think a lot of us would like to follow that. And he's basically paraphrasing the famous speech of Martin Luther King Jr. saying it's not the color of our skin, but the content of our character. But having said that, the powerfulness of identity politics in America is so great now that I think it's hard to get beyond that. That I think there are constituencies of African Americans, women, so forth, that do view electing somebody who looks like them very important, and who want to see in our office holders people who demographically represent them, who might share their experiences. And I think that's going to be a very powerful driver yet again this year. Whether we like it or not is a different story, but I think the reality is that the power of identity is real and it's not going away in the near future.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Jolie now in Mason. Jolie, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I've always been a big fan of Tammy Duckworth. I think she has grit. She's highly intelligent, a combat veteran, and I think she'd do great as a VP for our country.
Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, has she been on shortlist, David?
She's not been talked about as being on the shortlist, but she would bring a lot of, I think, interesting things to the vice presidency. I want to throw in, though, another dimension to think about here in terms of factors to consider for the vice presidency, is that the battle is not just for the presidency this year, but also for control of the U.S. Senate. And I think one of the things that has to be thought about here is, let us say, whether it's a Kamala Harris, it's an Elizabeth Warren, it's an Amy Klobuchar, let's say even if it were Tammy Baldwin, perhaps, as a possibility. What are the chances then of if the Democrats were to win and then have a senator leave, become vice president, can they replace that person in the Senate? And I think, although Illinois, it might be possible and pretty likely, but I think Biden and the Democrats are going to be thinking about that as an issue also in terms of how likely can they hold that seat. And I think that might be one thing, for example, that works against somebody like an Elizabeth Warren, where it's a Republican governor. If she steps down to become vice president, Republican governor gets to appoint somebody. And we know in the past that they're electing Republicans in Massachusetts. So we've also seen Republicans elected statewide office in Illinois. So these are factors to consider.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jolie. We're talking to David Schultz from Hamline University, looking at possible vice presidential choices for Joe Biden, the more or less sure thing Democratic candidate for president. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Landon is with us in Barneveld. Landon, hi.
Hi. I was just calling to see, I know earlier on in the election cycle, Stacey Abrams is possibly on the short list, but I haven't really heard a whole lot about her being on the short list in the more recent week. I was wondering if our speaker still thought that was a possibility. Thank you.
Thanks. So sure. Stacey Abrams, who had had outperformed Democrats' usual performance, running for governor of Georgia.
Yes, Stacey Abrams, I think, is on the short list. I'm not sure where she fits in, though, in terms of Biden's, let's say, real short list in terms of where it is. Now liberals love Stacey Abrams, and I think she would bring a lot in terms of helping the liberal vote. I think one of the concerns, and also, by the way, she's from Georgia, and Democrats would like to try to put Georgia in play if possible. I think the thing that bodes against her, though, is the fact that there are some people who claim and say that she lacks the experience to become president of the United States, you know, having been what I think was the Georgia legislature, and that they're concerned about to what extent that might factor into people's minds, much in the same way that when McCain was picked, had the nomination for president, when Sarah Palin was selected as vice president, the worry was, with McCain being so old, if something happened, what would happen if Palin got in? And I think that's the similar thinking here. I'm not saying she is or is not qualified. That's something for other people to make a judgment on. But I think that's a factor that's being considered with Stacey Abrams at this point.
Let's go back to your calls now. Peggy is with us in Viroqua. Peggy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a veteran, and the divisiveness right now in our country is horrific. I wasn't able to protest my age and everything else. I need to worry about the pandemic, too. But I want to see Kamala Harris or Kamala. Oh, I've got that wrong. Kamala Harris or Amy Klobuchar. I want one of them. Hopefully that they will make it with Biden. We've got to pull our country together. Kamala Harris has the legal background, and Amy Klobuchar, she's got the Midwestern background. And
Peggy, I'm going to jump in because we just have a couple minutes left. Now, Peggy mentioned Kamala Harris. Some people point back to some tough exchanges in the debates when Kamala Harris was still running for president. Is it easy enough to put those moments behind us when we're trying to form a presidential ticket?
I think, you know, they always use the expression, what, politics makes strange bedfellows. And I think the art of politics is one day being adversaries and the next day working together. And even though Harris got very close to almost putting Joe Biden out of the race, I mean, she was very, very aggressive with him. I think at the end of the day, that will be ignored. What I find interesting with Kamala Harris is that if you had asked me 7 months ago, what's the likely Democratic ticket, I would have said Biden and Harris. If you ask me now, I still say it's Biden and Harris. I'm going to throw out one other oddity. The woman who just called said she would like to see the country come together. She's not on the short list, but what if Joe Biden picked somebody like Condoleezza Rice and reached across the aisles or something? I don't think that's going to happen, but that would be an interesting possibility to consider also.
In our last few moments, David, I know you aren't reading anybody's minds here, but what do you think about the idea of timing when an announcement could or should come out, just in our last 30 seconds or so?
Sure. I think he's going to wait till very close, right before when the Democratic convention was supposed to occur, partly because they're doing the public vetting at this point, likes to make everybody sort of think they're still in. I suspect he already knows who it is at this point. He's just not telling anybody it is, but we'll wait till an appropriate point where it can have the biggest impact, again, right before the convention.
David, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you to the audience.
David Schultz is professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He joined us today for a look at Joe Biden's potential running mates and how George Floyd's death and recent protests could affect his choice. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, mental health experts say it's time to flatten another health curve, this time of anxiety and depression. We'll check out the scope of the problem and what we can do about it. Wisconsin schools are planning their budgets for the next school year with uncertainty about COVID-19 and whether they can have a normal school year. Find out how they're trying to get ready. And join this week's edition of Food Friday for some great Cajun recipes from the author of the new cookbook, The Mosquito Supper Club. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Kate and her guests look at the long history of African-American protesters trying to raise concerns over police brutality. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then when life gives you lemons, make some lemonade and maybe a backyard patio to drink it in. We'll talk about home projects you've done in recent months and get inspiration for some future ones as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.